Hello, and welcome to the Curiouser and Curiouser podcast. I'm Anna, the voice behind the Curiouser and Curiouser blog and podcast, and this is a space where we address a variety of topics. Everything from vegan baking, to entrepreneurship, to pregnancy, to developing a healthy relationship with food, and a whole lot more in between. I want to use this podcast to share things I find interesting or helpful or thought-provoking, things that will help us all learn something, or get a peek into someone else's experience that makes us feel part of something bigger. For today's episode, I chatted with my friend Brittany Todd. We know each other through Pure Bar, and Brittany is the woman behind Be Balanced Counseling and Wellness in downtown Winston. She's a licensed clinical mental health counselor offering a space for people to talk about, well, anything they might want some help dealing with. Brittany has wonderful experience, not to mention a strong personal story, that makes her well-suited for this work, as well as very passionate about it. She and I got together to talk about what Be Balanced is all about, including her vision for its future, and why people might want to consider talking with a therapist. We also spent lots of time discussing a past struggle she and I both share. We both suffered from disordered eating for several years, beginning as high schoolers. She talks about knowing the exact moment her journey with disordered eating began, and I actually have a distinct memory of when it began for me too. For me, it was when I was a junior in high school, and it was in the weeks leading up to prom. Brittany is very open about her journey with disordered eating, which I'm so grateful for. The thing is, this is an incredibly relevant topic for so many people, and so I think the best thing we can do to help is talk about it. Eating disorders are wrapped in shame and silence, so let's combat those things by sharing our experiences and letting others into our journeys, both the bright, shiny things and the darker, more challenging things. I'm so thankful to Brittany for chatting with me and for sharing her personal journey. And if you're in Winston and are looking for someone to talk to, whether it's for support as you deal with an eating disorder or with another issue, definitely check out Be Balanced. Ready to hear Brittany Todd? Here we go. All right, so Brittany, I'm so excited to be here with you today. I think you're going to have a lot of really great things to say and to just kind of hammer home the importance of mental health as part of our whole health and help people understand the work that you do, why you do it, the kinds of things that you help people work through. I think that it'll be really, really special. We have a few shared connections. We both live here in Winston, lots of friends in common, and then we overlap a lot at Pure Bar as well, which is really fun. So I love that I think our friendship kind of started there, and it's been neat to watch it connect in other ways too. But I would love to have you first share with our listeners about what drew you to this field to begin with. You work to support people as they're working through, you know, life issues, mental health issues. What was it that made you want to be a part of that really important work?
Yeah, so I have quite the story in terms of mental health myself. That probably started when I was 5 or 6. My parents got divorced and continued on through high school and college and even adulthood in terms of different struggles that I faced and ways to face them, as well as just excessive behaviors and just very unhealthy habits that led me to have my own experience in counseling from age 6 and on, that then led me to wanting to create a different approach for people that I see in my office. So as a licensed clinical mental health counselor, I have created an environment that I wanted my whole life to be able to, a safe place to be able to come and share and get help in whatever capacity. And so that's where we are.
That's really neat. It's interesting that you have such a long history with counseling yourself from, you know, the other side of things, which probably I'm sure helped you easily identify things that you liked about that model and things that you thought could be done a little bit better. But it's great that you had such a long background to pull from.
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I mean, at the time, I didn't think it was great, but it certainly helps me now.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Do you feel like because you started, since you started counseling so young, do you feel like some of the stigma that I feel like our culture has as a whole around mental health was a little bit lessened for you because it was such a part of your life so early? Or was it still something, because a lot of your peers may not have been experiencing it too, that you kind of felt like you didn't want to talk to too many people about, that it felt like something that was different about you?
I think that that depended on what time I was, like, or what period in my life it was. Obviously, when I was a kid, like, it wasn't really something that I knew. I thought it was this weird thing that I had to go do, and I wasn't really sure how it was helping me. And I don't know that it did when I was little, because I didn't really understand the point. It was, like, a lot of testing and stuff like that. But as I got older, like high school, yeah, I thought it was cool. I saw Michael Hayes, who works at Pathways Counseling on Robin Hood, and I remember, like, driving by and be like, oh, that's where Mike works. Like, he's my counselor. That's so cool. So that never really bothered me. In college, I think I hid from a lot of people, probably because things were more intense. And I didn't, like, it was kind of the stigma in the sense of I swam for University of Florida. So if you were having to go to a counselor, then something was not right. And so it was like, we just didn't talk about it a lot. I don't know that it helped me, or the counselor that I saw in college, I don't know that it helped me at all either. So I approached it because of the stigma, I approached it with like, nothing's wrong with me. I'm just doing this because they're making me kind of thing. But definitely after that, you know, after graduating from college and moving forward just in my, like in through grad school and my adult life, and anything else that has come up, it's definitely has just been something like, that is just as normal for me as going to get a massage. You know, you get your massage, you get your pedicure, you get your blood work done, and you go to counseling. Like, to me, it just seems normal.
I love that. I hope that we as a culture can get more to that point. This is a bit of a side note, but I just read the book, Maybe You Should Talk to Someone. Have you read that? By Lori Gottlieb.
I've heard of it, but I've never read it.
Yeah, so it's great. It's a memoir. Written by a therapist about her own experience with therapy as a therapist, and then some of her clients as well. And she talks about that, about like, you know, how she was worried to choose a therapist as a therapist because she would wonder, well, people are going to think, what's wrong with her? Is she depressed? Is she like, what's she dealing with? So I think it can exist no matter how close you can be to therapy. So I'm glad to hear for you that it seems like a really normal part of life at this point.
Yeah.
Well, neat. Well, dig in a little bit more about Be Balanced, about your practice. You talked about wanting to create a different model, a more holistic model than the one that you experienced. What does that mean? How does that come to life?
So it's been a process. Before we moved back to Winston-Salem, because I grew up here, we lived in Pawleys Island, South Carolina for 7 years, where I developed and ran a wellness studio called Be Balanced. But at that time, it was just Be Balanced Wellness. And it was we had a full yoga studio, a full personal training studio. I did life coaching at the time because I was in grad school, but I had a life coaching certification. And then also massage therapy. And then some energy healing stuff. So it was like a whole wellness space. And I loved the concept of the fact that like you could get your workout in, you could go to a life coaching session and you could get a massage and then you could move on. And you know, had a yoga class later in the day if you wanted, I guess. But it was hard when we moved here to be able to kind of bring that back to life just because of the different demographic of Winston-Salem versus obviously Pawleys Island. But I sold my studio there and kept the name because the name meant so much to me, because I think it's something that I find in life is this balance and still am trying to do, but I think it's literally impossible to actually achieve balance in life. So when we moved here, after I finished like North Carolina supervision hours and all of that, I wanted to create a similar place to what I had in Pawleys, or at least kind of play off of that, which then led me to open my own private practice in clinical counseling here, and where our office is located on Burke Street in downtown Winston. And, you know, in terms of my personal approach to counseling, use an integrative approach. So sometimes I'm more clinical, sometimes I'm more mind-body. It kind of depends on what the client needs. But ultimately, my goal would be to also be able to incorporate massage therapy and another clinician here as well. But in the meantime, we have partnered with CycleBar and Winston-Salem. So we kind of work to get people, you know, hey, to manage your stress, like go in this direction, you know, and obviously I'm pretty vocal about what I do in terms of like ping-ponging from CycleBar and Pure Bar and running and yoga, to encourage that within my clients. If that answers your question.
Yeah, no, I love that. And trying to connect those kind of natural links between all the different types of wellness. That sounds like an amazing studio that you had in Pawleys Island. And having been to your office here, I can speak to the fact that it doesn't feel like a doctor's office. It doesn't feel like, you know, you're in a, you know, dentist waiting room. It feels very comfortable, but it's modern. And I love the space that you've created. So I can totally envision that growing into something even bigger than what you've already got there. That's really cool. Well, so let's talk about like what some of the key things. So you talk about, you know, trying to achieve balance, like working through issues in your life. What are some of the key things that might tell a person it might be time, it might be a good idea to come see you? What things might be going on in their life that could trigger that first appointment?
So a million things. But I would say the most common ones that I see are physical symptoms. You know, somebody is feeling as if they have the flu all the time or getting headaches all the time. Having like your heart is racing for whatever reason, trouble sleeping, stuff like that, that like a lot of, because of our society, you know, we're taught to push through things and stuff like that. So often people see physical symptoms before they address the emotional and mental issues that could be going on. So that usually happens, which it's a series of events, you know, they're having these physical symptoms that land them in the doctor, right? So they go see their PCP and their PCP's like, there's nothing wrong with you, but you should go talk to somebody. So that happens. Occasionally we even get people who are referred from the hospital because of whatever reason, whether they've gone in thinking that they were having a heart attack, but it was just anxiety, you know, or if all of a sudden they were overcome with negative thoughts. So that would be the physical standpoint. The emotional, it usually comes from, you know, somebody realizes that they're crying a lot, or they realize that they're just really not happy and they're having to fake being happy. I'll get patients that are replaying conversations in their head, or even pre-playing conversations in their head that's just taking over like most of their like present interactions with people. And then, you know, when it comes to, I don't know, maybe at least 30% of the people that I see initially, it's a loved one that sent them. You know, it's my mom's made me come, or my sister really wants me to be here, or my husband told me I need to talk to somebody, you know, or my wife is mad at me because I keep doing this. So she told me I needed to go to counseling. And then it ends up that they're here for much bigger reasons, and it works out. So whoever lands here obviously is here for the right reason, and they need to be here. So it doesn't always matter how they get here, but there's a bunch of different avenues.
Well, let's dig into one kind of pathway in particular, one topic in particular, because it's one that you and I both share as it relates to counseling and support. And it sounds like, and I'm interested to hear a little bit more about your journey, it sounds like there was some overlap, but then maybe there were some differences too between kind of how we dealt with this. But both of us suffered from eating disorders for several years. And for me, that started in high school, and it extended more than a decade beyond that. And it was like the biggest secret of my whole life. Like, I didn't want anyone to know. I ended up initially going to therapy because my husband, Kevin, found out. Like, he didn't even know when we got married, and he found out. And to your point, like many of your patients that you see, suggested, really encouraged that I go talk to somebody. And I did, but I wasn't at the place where I was yet ready to deal with it. And so that wasn't all that effective at that point. And I had to give it, I don't know, two or three more years to get to a place that I was really, really ready to deal with it head on. And then at that point I sought out some counseling again, and that time it stuck. That time I was at the place where I was ready. And so that was a really, really critical piece of my healing process, of my getting better, my recovery. And I don't know, I'd be interested to hear your story too, and to also hear a little bit about what you typically see when people come to you with an eating disorder. what that process has looked like for them and what the trigger is for them to go and talk to someone. And I want to bring this up because if somebody's listening who's dealing with an eating disorder and like me, maybe like you, felt so much shame around this big, big secret, to know that that it's okay and it's a really, really, really important part of the process of getting better to bring somebody in and kind of build this little circle of support around yourself, and that recovery genuinely is possible, which is something that I did not think was true when I was on the other side of it.
Yeah. And it's funny, when you get all the way on the other side, you're like, man, why did I even do that?
Yeah.
Okay. So this is a long answer for me. So I can tell you the day that it all began for me. And I was a junior in high school, and I went to R.D. Reynolds here in Winston. And I had been at a girls' council meeting that afternoon. And I was a competitive swimmer growing up, and I swam for University of Florida, and I was very good. I went to Olympic trials in 2000 and 2004, and then my career ended due to surgeries, which is a whole other story. But there was always the pressure, like, as an athlete to be, like, thin and fit, and especially in swimming, like, the less you weigh, the less muscle mass and body fat you have to move through the water. And you know, there are different periods of time where we would gain weight or lose weight based on how much we were training. So this happened to be right where we were doing what you call tapering. And it is like where you decrease your training in an effort to be rested and ready for a swim meet, a big swim meet. And so I was really worried that during this time, because it would be less activity, I would gain weight. And this became a very vicious cycle in my life for the next, you know, 6 years. But at this time, I was at the girls' council meeting that afternoon, and I had 3 brownies. And I have no idea what made me have the 3 brownies, but I did. And I don't know if I was stressed earlier in the day or whatever it was, but I got home from that. And I did have the foresight to call my mom, and I was like, do you think I should make myself throw up? And she was like in a meeting, and she was like, what are you talking about? No. Just no, go to swim practice and like let it go. But if, like, I didn't listen, and I did make myself throw up. And then that was the beginning of this like new skill that I had learned that was going to be able to help me do the things that I want to do, at least in my brain, and maintain like the persona and the appearance that I needed to maintain. Things did not get really bad until probably my freshman year of college. It would kind of go up and down, especially senior year, you know, nothing to the point that people noticed. And I would not purge every day. I think I constantly restricted. I remember pulling noodles out of chicken noodle soup from Panera and giving them to my best friend across the table. I remember even before this, they even did this, but like at Subway, like scooping all the bread out and like just, you know, and it was just like these weird things that people were like, what are you doing? But I was like, oh no, I have to do this because of this. And so no one really thought twice about it. And it wasn't that big of a deal. At least I thought. And in my head, I could have stopped any time. I was just choosing to do this because this was helping me achieve a goal. And it was being positively reinforced because I was swimming really well. And I went on a full ride to UF in 2003. And then in 2004, all of this continued, and I swam in Olympic trials. And I did not do as well as I had expected. And things had been really bad for me that summer in terms of eating disorder, because I had gained a little bit of weight before NCAAs earlier in 2004. And the swim coach at UF, his name's Greg Troy, he is now retired, but he was also like, he was just known as being like really, a really difficult coach, but a really good coach. And he actually was the head coach for the Olympic team, I think in 2008 and 2012. So he was like, he knew what he was doing. And on the pool deck at NCAAs, he asked me, what moves faster in the water, a paddle boat or a canoe? Insinuating that I was a paddle boat. And then for the rest of that summer, required me and another friend of mine actually to see the nutritionist, where we would get our body fat and our measurements and our weight done every Wednesday and then bring it to him on a printed out piece of paper.
Wow.
So this was all I needed to like go like DEFCON 5, like hardcore, like let's do the eating disorder. So then we were purging, restricting, and overexercising. I would go to practice, you know, and then run afterwards. On Sundays, which were our day off, I would run 8 miles. I remember my parents coming down for a weekend and literally holding me down and being like, I'm sorry, you're not going to run and you're going to eat pancakes. I really didn't see a big deal in this until I didn't swim well in Olympic trials. And then, you know, it continued after that. And then we get to October of 2004 and I injured my shoulder for the first time. And it was just a labral tear and it was like, you know, supposed to be no big deal. But I never really fully recovered from it because I was never giving my body the right nutrition. And if, like, hindsight, obviously, but that's why it happened to begin with. I wasn't giving myself enough protein. I wasn't getting, you know, enough recovery, nutrients and stuff like that, which had been an issue even in high school when I would develop these new things about, you know, in terms of eating disorder behavior of I'm going to be a vegan. You know, I'm a vegetarian now, all in an effort to see how thin I could get. And so I just, you know, that continued. I came back from that surgery the same way I went into it. So over-exercising, restricting. I was allowed to come home that summer of 2005 only because I had, you know, recently had surgery and was coming back. But I was allowed to come home under the pretense that I came back thinner, according to my coach, because we had kind of gotten back a bit in this cycle. And my weight had been somewhat steady the whole time, so no one knew until I came back from that. So when I was at home over the summer in 2005, things got really bad, and I was, again, purging. But I was purging, and I was also taking laxatives at this point. And I was a master at that, like would time them, you know, to where I somehow ended up very dehydrated and absorbed no calories. And I was exercising probably 10 hours a day, doing various things. And it was somewhat acceptable because I was a, you know, NCAA athlete, but it's not. If you look back at my journals, like from that time, I'd recorded what I was doing and I had do not eat weeks. And the obsessiveness that had happened was just unreal. I even like constructed or put together a 26.2 miles throughout Winston-Salem because I thought that I needed to run a marathon in order to have chocolate cake one night, which I think I probably purged, to be honest. So that's when things peaked to the point where, and like, I talk about this stuff all the time, so, you know, whoever's listening, like, this is a lot, but like, it had gotten to the point that on the way to Hilton Head that summer, I was riding with my mom and my stepfather was driving my car and she was like, she hadn't said anything about it all summer long, even though I had even passed out on a run on Faculty Drive going into Wake Forest because I was so dehydrated and, you know, malnourished. But she had just attributed that to hot weather. But she did mention something about, you know, how there had been somebody that recently passed away from taking laxatives. And that was kind of about all she really said. And then, of course, like an hour later, I was driving my car and my stepfather was back in the car with her. And I had to call and be like, we have to stop right now because I have to go to the bathroom because I had completely lost control of like bodily functions. And it was like a very humbling moment to me. And I was like, this is not good. But that's all I let myself think. And then I didn't stop doing it. And like, you know, with your husband, right? It was my boyfriend who staged this entire intervention when I got back to school in 2005 and like took all the laxatives and threw them away. And like my friends wouldn't let me go to the bathroom by myself. And I wish I could say that it stopped there, but it definitely didn't. And that was when they made me go to counseling. And like, you know, like I didn't care. I was like, I mean, there were a bunch of other issues that I had, obviously, that were contributing to all of this, but I did not want to talk to this person about it. I did not have any interest in stopping what I was doing. In my head, I was on a mission always to achieve a specific goal, which is what I see a lot in terms of eating disorders. In what I see in my practice and the way I approach things, eating disorders are addictions. I think they stem from other things, but at the end of the day, it becomes an addictive process. And at that point in my like disordered eating career, kind of, I was completely addicted and had no interest in stopping it. I like waffled on and off for a while. I ended up then having to, like that fall of 2005, ended up tearing my rotator cuff and dislocating my shoulder that permanently ended my swimming career. Again, because I had not nourished my body enough to recover from the surgery prior. And that was just devastating on many levels. And then I continued with disordered eating for however long, not to the extent that it was when I was an athlete. And then I told myself that it was over when I left college, but that was when it kind of morphed into binge eating disorder when I was alone, like living by myself for the first time where nobody ever watched me eat. And so I would eat like boxes and boxes of cereal. Like if you asked me to eat a Fruit Loop or a Honey Nut Cheerio right now, I think it would give me anxiety to this day. It was like, I just would eat a ton of it. I remember calling Michael Hayes in the middle of the night and leaving this frantic voicemail on his office voicemail and was like, I think that now I have binging disorder. Like, how are we going to fix this? And then like the next morning when he called me, I was like, no, I'm okay. I'm good. And so that, I mean, I just continued and then I would get better at that point. Like I would be like, okay, we're going to stop this. It's going to be fine. And then I got engaged and then we started the whole, you know, the society of you've got to look your really best for your wedding. Like you've got to fit in the dress and all of this stuff. And having gained a little bit of weight, because I wasn't doing what I was doing as often, I became my mission to then be as skinny as possible for my wedding because, you know, those pictures, you want them, those pictures follow you forever. My dress was really tight, like to this day, I remember that. And I was like, I do not, you know, you get nervous. So I like didn't want to not be able to breathe. So I went right back to what I know what to do. And I exercised for like 6 to 8 hours a day prior to that. And I restricted like no other, like I didn't even drink like wine or champagne, like nothing like going into it because I was like, I can't have any extra calories. And then on my wedding day, did not eat like at all. May have had a couple of bites of something like at lunch when we were getting our hair done. So if you can imagine that in combination of nerves from your wedding plus dehydration from hours of dancing and copious amounts of champagne, needless to say, my husband at that time carried me out of our wedding reception. And then I refused to eat and actually like fell asleep in the food that night. And it was our honeymoon that he finally said something to me about it and was like, this has got to stop because I'm watching you. I'm watching you kill yourself over this. And, he was like, you're beautiful to me, however, and all of these things. And that's when it stopped. It was like, somebody just like put the stop sign in front of me. And I was like, okay, wait, I'm married and I love this man and I don't want to lose him. And therefore I am not going to do this anymore. And it, you know, there's been different times in my life where it's kind of like popped up because I think it never truly goes away. And there's been like a voice in my head that's like, oh, hey, you probably shouldn't eat that or you should worry about that. Like at different times, usually in times of extreme stress. But never again have I ever done anything like that. And it was just simply because I decided I was done. And it required work, you know, on everything that led to that to even begin with and why that was a coping skill and why I felt that that was what determined my self-worth and everything. But ultimately, I think, and when I work with clients that are dealing with the same thing, it's that decision that, okay, now I'm done. Now I'm done. And then we work on, well, how did you get to this point? So I see people who come into my office at all different, journeys, like all different points in their journey with disordered eating. And some of it's like, maybe they're just thinking about it because they want to lose weight and it works both ways. You know, maybe they're thinking about it because they want to gain weight. And I mean, you may have this too, but like in different times as I've gotten older and even actually funny, we're even talking about this because I had this conversation with my husband last night. Cause I was like at 35, like I thought I would never, ever say this. And like, 20-year-old Brittany is like mad at me right now, but I have lost a lot of weight recently, like since having my second child, and it almost makes me really like self-conscious because I don't want to not look like a woman. And like 20-year-old Brittany would be so mad. She'd be like, why? You should be happy that you're that, you know? So it's just, I see people that want to gain weight, that want to lose weight, you know, and are obsessing about it to whichever angle. And I totally understand both sides of it. So we, you know, focus immediately on self-worth. Now, if somebody comes into my office where they are demonstrating malnourishment, or, you know, have done like other things, like their hair is falling out, they are excessively thin, they've passed out, they're not feeling well, or, you know, their symptoms have gone further than that. You know, eating disorders are a way that we can punish ourselves, like as well as an addiction and also a form of self-harm. So often disordered eating is coupled with cutting. It's coupled with, you know, any kind of other form of self-harm. So if we've gotten that far, I usually refer out to treatment facilities, and we work with Veritas in Raleigh relatively frequently. And, you know, then they get discharged, and then we work on, okay, how did we, now that we're healthier, where do we go from here? Like, how did you even get to this point? And then I've had some kids that have, you know, and women that have been in and out of facilities for however long, but have yet to make that decision of I'm done. So I think it all comes down to, in order to move into recovery and knowing that it is possible, is that final, like your final decision that nobody else can decide for you. There's no therapist, there's no treatment facility, there's no other person in your life or that you would come in contact with that can say, well, I guess everybody can say you need to stop. This is bad. This is what's happening. Like you're hurting yourself. But until you, like the individual is ready to say, I'm done, I want to move past this and I'm finished and I'm not going to do this anymore. I know it's going to be hard, but I'm not going to do this. No progress can be made.
Yeah, I can relate so much to a lot of points of your story. And that's how I felt when I reached that point. I just remember feeling so tired of it. I was so over it. I was over, because at that point, I do feel like for me, it was very much an addiction. It was a habit. It was this habit that I was doing every single day. And then every day I'd wake up and say, I'm not going to do it today, but I would. And it would just be this exhausting cycle. And I was like, you know what? I know I'm going to have to deal with some things that are beneath the surface of this, but that's okay. Like that feels worth it to get to the other side. One of the big hangups for me that took me a while to get to that place, and I remember obsessively like Googling about it and whatever, was the physical piece, was worrying if I take this tool away, what's going to happen to my body? Like, what's going to happen to me? Is it going to be, and so I remember just spending so much time reading other people's journeys, and it's like, did they gain weight at first and then maybe kind of regulate? And then it reached this point where I was like, you know what? I don't even care. I just need to get to a place where this isn't like the focus of my life all the time.
Yeah, I think it just really sucks. And that's all you think about, you know, and that's what it comes down to. Like you wake up in the morning and you think, okay, what am I going to eat for breakfast? And then do I purge that or do I wait? Then I'll just skip lunch. And then what are we having for dinner tonight? If I'm taking lactose, what time do I need to do that? Like, and you really miss out on what's actually happening right in front of you. You know, and I see it in, you know, kids that are in high school and their grades will fall, you know, because they can't actually think about what they're supposed to study or what's, you know, going on. They're thinking about like what they're going to eat for lunch and if they could skip their lunch and will people notice that kind of thing, you know, and then adults, like it's so hard. We've got way too many things to think about rather than when and what and where to eat and how many calories that has and what we look like in the mirror. And that doesn't even touch the piece of self-worth. And why would we be judging our self-worth and our self-esteem based on a number or a measurement or a size?
Right. It's so helpful to have perspective and some distance from it to be able to realize like, yeah, it's what a sad thing to have done to myself. It's tragic if I'd heard that same story happening to a friend, like you hearing your story just now, like makes me feel sad for the younger version of you. And yet I did the same thing. And I feel sad for the younger version of me too. So, tell me what, okay. So I think about this a lot, as somebody who suffered from an eating disorder and for so long, and now as somebody who's the mother of a daughter, not that, you know, guys aren't susceptible to eating disorders too, because I know they certainly are as well, but I think it still tends to be more of a female thing, and there's still so much pressure around the way we look. And I know you're mom to a daughter as well. What sort of, I guess what sort of advice do you have for mothers of daughters, especially ones where the mothers have suffered from disordered eating? Like, what is a good, what's a good thing for us to do as it relates to our girls, helping them grow up, you know, because there's only so much we can do in our homes to make things feel not food focused, not body focused. They're going to be out in the world. They're going to be getting messages from media, from culture. So just what do you think some good practices are so that hopefully they don't get to a place where they either develop any eating disorder at all, or if they do, that we can kind of help to detect that and address it early, even though it's difficult, because to your point, it kind of comes down to the person being ready to deal with it.
Totally. Okay. So I think there's a number of things. Like, one is just normalizing everything. You know, like, we go to extremes in our society to, like, either protect our kids from things or force our kids into things, all because we want the best for them. You know, so I have a lot of moms that ask me, like, should I not have a scale in my house? My answer is always no, have a scale. Like, we all have to be able to stand on the scale and look at the number and be like, okay, cool. Like, I'm a healthy person. You know, that's the thing. You can't not have a scale, because then the scale seems bad. And then you go to the doctor's office and the scale is intimidating. And why would we create fear around a scale? You know? So my answer to that is, like, have a scale, you know, like weigh yourself, but once every 2 months, I don't know, you know, or something, but just have it there so that we all look at it and we go, oh, that's a normal thing to have in a house. As far as, you know, food and stuff in our house, which is interesting because we're like the celiac disease house, but we focus on health, you know, like in the balance per se, right? So if you have to eat something healthy in order to get something unhealthy, which in my house, because of celiac disease, is relative. But, you know, like, you're not going to get dessert unless you eat your peas, kind of thing. You know, not that you have to eat your peas. It's like, but you, if you want this, then this, right? So we do put a pretty big emphasis on health in general. I don't at all, in my own, like, practice as a mother, or in my recommendations, like in counseling, I never recommend parents force children to eat, you know? So, like, it's never like, you know, 10 more bites of this, or you have to finish that. You know, if your kid's sitting at the table refusing to eat their dinner, but wanting ice cream afterwards, then it's a, you have to eat this in order to get this, but never a, you have to make a happy plate. I try, although I am guilty because I'm not, you know, superhuman mommy over here, but I try really hard not to do like the happy plate thing, you know, because like in my sensitivity, I feel like that can lead to some sort of binge eating thing or being overfull. Like, it's eat till you feel like you've nourished your body and move on. I instill a big like eat to live instead of live to eat kind of thing. And then I also try really hard, but I mean, of course this happens every now and then, but not to reward my kids with food. Because I don't, especially with Clara, who's my daughter, like, I don't want her to grow up, you know, thinking, okay, I achieved this, so now I'm going to have cookies. I want it to be more like, I achieved this, I'm going to go get my nails done. Because then food becomes a coping skill, because it's a reward or a punishment. And if we're eating to live, food is not a reward or a punishment, it's a necessity.
Yeah, I like that philosophy. That's one thing that I've tried to be conscious of with my daughter too. And she's only 2.5, so we're kind of at the start of that journey. But like, yeah, trying to go ahead and decide what that's going to look like for our family. And then I totally agree with the not forcing them to eat. Like, I always think about how, like, she is as in tune with her body as she will ever be, like, definitely way more than I am. So the last thing I want to do is try to disrupt that intuition that she has and just some days you're going to be hungrier than others, and we're just going to try to roll with it. And that can be really challenging as a parent when you're like in a situation, especially if there are other people around and you're just trying to kind of manage a mealtime. But I try to keep that thought in mind of like letting her kind of listen to her body.
And that continues all the way through, I think, for forever, because in reality there are, especially as women, like there will be more days where we are hungrier than others. And so the warning signs, you know, in a high school or in middle school or college, you know, when you're looking at your kids, are they never hungry? Do we have consecutive days of not being hungry? And if that happens and you know, their blood work looks good and all of that, then there could be something bigger going on, which at that point would be your answer to, now you need to go talk to somebody. Because in reality, like there, you know, there really is not a lot of balance in life. So, but then at the same time there is. So it's, you're hungry one day, you're hungry the next. And so that's how it goes always, you know? So I think you just let your body decide, because if you really listen to your body, it'll tell you what it needs. And with that being said, like in our house, at least, healthy is not determined by your weight or your body or anything like that. It's determined by how strong you are, like what you can accomplish. So I do try to set a good example of like, hey, I'm going to Cycle Bar now, and now I'm going to Pure Bar, and hey, guess what? Like, I did my first Pure Bar intensive a couple of weeks ago, and like I told Clara, who's my daughter, I was like, I'm going to go do this, and like if I come back and lay on the ground, you know that I worked really hard. And I was so sore the next day, and she was like, are you really sore from your workout? And I was like, yeah, but I was like really strong. And so she takes that on too, and she's active, and she realizes that that's important. I went to Cycle Bar last night, and I came home with my water bottle, and my son was like, oh, you went to your cycling class. I was like, yeah. So it's a normal thing. Like being healthy, working out, being strong, and eating to live is just, it's just part of our everyday world. And we have a scale. So we've got that going for us.
Yeah. I like that too. Just kind of making movement part of life, and where they see that connected to you being the best version of you versus this thing that you have to do because you need to look a certain way. When your kids get a little bit older, because this is something I've thought about too, do you plan on like sharing your journey with them in an effort to like let them in on it and just give them a little bit of a warning? Like, hey, this happened to me. I just want to make sure you know how bad that was, and I want you to avoid it and also be able to look out for friends who might be dealing with the same thing.
Yeah, I think that at least in my line of work and the amount of self-disclosure I use with all of my clients, it would be impossible for them not to know about it. Sometimes I feel like the majority of Winston Salem knows, but yes, I mean, absolutely. Like it, all of this is just normal. Well, I mean, not with a 6-year-old and 4-year-old, but we'll just be normal talk at our house. Like, we're very open. The eating disorder piece of my life is just like, it was a huge thing, but it was also a blimp on the mental health spectrum that was my journey to being where I am today. So it is definitely something that we will talk about, because, you know, this whole idea of being normal is not real. Yeah, so there's no real, like, normal. So it will all be something open for discussion in terms of food and my journey with eating disorders, and then just anxiety, depression, sex, drugs, and alcohol. Like, we will talk about it all. And that's my best recommendation for any parent, because if you can't talk about it, it makes it seem like it's wrong or bad or, you know, like something that we should ignore. But if we can all talk about something and normalize it, then nothing is abnormal, and everything seems something that we can leave to open discussion and like facilitate really healthy lines of communication between parents and children.
Yeah, I totally, totally agree with that. I know for me, my eating disorder, like one of the things that it helped me do was suppress emotions in a big way, and like it numbed all of that. And so I had to do a lot of hard work to kind of like relearn things that seemed very basic, like what am I feeling right now? I actually don't really have any idea. And so trying to foster that closeness to your emotions and being able to talk about them, being able to verbalize what you're feeling, I think that's something that's a really big deal for me and something that I hope to be able to do within our house consistently. So I love that.
Yeah, good.
Well, it's not easy. It's not easy, but worth it. So
yeah, totally.
Well, this has been amazing. And thank you for your openness and too, just for the work that you're doing. I love that we have such a holistic resource, right here in Winston. As we kind of wrap up, is there anything else that you want people to know either about Be Balanced or just kind of anything you want to leave people with as far as a thought on health in general?
You know, your health is really important. I think that we have a tendency to put our own health aside from everybody else's health, especially as mothers, you know, or parents in general. And even growing up, you know, we think that our academics are more important than our health, whether that's mental or physical. We think that our sport is more important than our health, mental and physical. We will push through in an effort to succeed, thinking that our success determines our happiness as opposed to our health determining our happiness. And the bottom line is, if you don't have your health, then you really don't have a lot. And you have to be able to operate from a full cup. And if you aren't taking care of yourself, both physically and mentally, then one of the two is going to fall and you're not going to be the best version of yourself. So as a clinical counselor, I see everything from, you know, schizophrenia and mood disorders to eating disorders to I'm mad at my best friend, or I'm so stressed out, I'm having trouble breathing, and anxiety and depression, and all of these things that contribute to ultimately our health. So really, if there's anything that I emphasize and like would leave everybody with, it is that your health is the most important part of your life, because without that, you cannot give to everyone else in your life to the, you know, to your full capacity, and you will not be the best version of yourself.
I think that's such a good reminder. To your point, it's so easy to have the tendency to just want to push it to the back burner, but it's not only good for us, but it's good for the people we love to make sure that we're doing well physically and mentally.
Yeah, and then with your kids, you set a good example. They watch your every move. So, I mean, not that we're all going to always be super, super healthy, but as long as you're putting that on the top priority list and doing all you can, then you're good to go.
Yep, I like that a lot. Well, thank you, Brittany. This has been awesome. I'm so excited that we got to connect. So glad for people to get to hear from you. And I'll link to your website and stuff like that so people can know how to follow along with all the great stuff you have going on. Thank you so much.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks, Anna.
Yeah.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Don't forget to head over to my blog, curiouser-and-curiouser.com, for more information on Be Balanced and on Brittany. Thank you so much for taking the time to listen to the Curiouser and Curiouser podcast. I know your time is limited and it's precious, and it means so much that you've spent some of it here with me today. Until next time, I'll leave you with a quote by Roy Bennett about curiosity. Enjoy every step you take. If you're curious, there is always something new to be discovered in the backdrop of your daily life. Talk to you soon.